Robert Dagey, July 31st, 1985, Thomas Merton, and the Seven Story Mountain.
Good evening.
I was asked yesterday to provide a list of what I thought would be good introductory reading on Thomas Merton, and so I provided such a list. I think any reading of Merton must start with The Seven Story Mountain, which was published in 1948, which is now available in an HBJ Harcourt Brace Harvest paperback. The next one is my personal favorite. It's Merton's journal from the years following the completion of the writing of The Seven Story Mountain up until 1952. And I think in The Sign of Jonas, one finds probably his best writing, as far as I am concerned. It is a journal, a diary. Many people, including me, think that Merton was best in this particular form, the kind of episodic, short, little vignettes that one tends to get in the diary form. Then, probably his major work on contemplation and or meditation, depending on how you want to define the term, was Seeds of Contemplation, first published in 1949, soon after the publication of The Seven Story Mountain. It was the only book that Merton himself revised during his lifetime, and it was reissued in 1962 as New Seeds of Contemplation, and is available still in paperback from New Directions. Then, a late journal writing, Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, published in 1966, available, I believe, from Image, Doubleday Image paperbacks. This one, I think, is particularly significant, not only because of the writing, some of which is beautiful, but in this one, one gets much more of Thomas Merton, the social critic, writing on society with his views there. Then another of my personal favorites, Zen and the Birds of Appetite, published in 1968, shortly before his death, available for New Directions still in paperback, dealing with Thomas Merton's interest in the East, in Zen and Buddhism. And I have added the recently published mammoth volume of the letters. This is just, as I said, the first volume. These are the letters on religious experience and social concerns. It is not a book, I think, that one picks up to read straight through from beginning to end. In fact, if you try to do that, I think one gets swamped and it's ultimately disappointing. It's the kind of book that you pick up and read. Or if you want to know what Thomas Merton had to say to a Jewish theologian, you pick it up and read those letters. If you want to know what he had to say to the Berrigans, the draft card burners, you pick it up and read that section. But I did include it because I think the publication of the letters shows Merton in a different light. Even more than in his journal writings, he tends to be candid, pretty open, and pretty blunt. And I might add, for those of you who might be bothered by it, pretty earthy at times. And then finally, anyone who might be interested in his poetry, there is a little paperback published in 61 called Selected Poems, and then a mammoth volume published in 1977 called Collected Poems, now available in paperback and about that thick. Yes.
Of the ones you've listed, the two that are in the bookstore on your list are the third and the fourth, The New Seeds and Conjectures.
Thank you. They do have some other things,
yeah,
all of which have some value. This is just what I think would make a nice nucleus as an introductory reading list for Thomas Merton. Now, and of course I think it's always important to read the person himself first. But if you would like to read about Thomas Murphy, there are now over 50 books about Murphy, many of which, mercifully, are out of print at this point in time. Merton Studies has been in an embryonic phase for a long time. I hope we're beginning to get out of that. If I have to pick up one more thing and read on the first page, he was born in Prague on the last day of January 1915 and died in Bangkok, blah-de-blah. Anyway, I think these are five of the better things that have been written. None of these happen to be doctoral dissertations. A lot of the published books on Merton have been doctoral dissertations, which unfortunately always read like doctoral dissertations. If you've ever read any, you'll know what I mean. Sometimes it's like walking through mud. The first of these is the one I've been showing you this week. The Authorized Biography of Thomas Merton, The Seven Mountains of Thomas Merton by Michael Mott. Some almost 700 pages long. It has been called an encyclopedic biography, and indeed it is. Like the letters, I would advise its use as a reference tool rather than something you sit down and read from beginning to end. It's almost overwhelming. It's excellent, don't get me wrong, but there's just so much detail that I think one almost gets bogged down in the very detail. But it is useful as a reference tool. I think on the market now, probably the best thing about Merton, which gives an overview of his life, is a book by an English woman, Monica Furlong. Some of you may know her. She's a rather well-known writer. She wrote a book which was a bestseller in England called Traveling In. Monica came to this in an odd way. Shortly after Merton's death, well, he had left instructions that an authorized biographer was to be appointed and to have access only to certain materials. So soon after his death, the Merton trustees appointed his friend, John Howard Griffin. And I'm sure many of you know of John Howard Griffin. Probably, if you don't know him by name, you know his best known work, Black Like Me. He is the man who colored his skin, took pigment injections, and traveled through the South living as a black man. He and Merton were very close friends. Well, for a variety of reasons, Griffin, although he was appointed in 69, never got around to finishing the biography. The British publishers wanted a book, so they just canceled their contract with Griffin and appointed Monica Furlong. Her book, Merton, A Biography, it was published in 1980 to almost unanimously rave reviews. Then Anthony T. Padovano, The Human Journey, Thomas Merton, Symbol of a Century, published in 1982 and available now in paperback, I think is significant, although I don't always agree with Tony's interpretations of some parts of Merton's life. It's the first work that has really tried to put Merton into the context of the 20th century and what he meant in and for the 20th century. The reason I say I don't agree with Tony sometimes, he left the priesthood and married a former nun. And when he gets to Merton's romance with the nurse in 1966, Tony rather feels maybe Merton should have left and married the nurse. That's the significant point where I disagree with him. Then Brother Patrick Hart, who was at one time Merton's secretary at the Abbey, put together a collection of writings by religious, not only monks, but some nuns and other priests, called Thomas Merton Monk, A Monastic Tribute, first published in 1974 and a revised edition in 1983. And I think very helpful because it gives a number of views that, people close to Merton in the monastic and religious life had. And finally, the best work on Merton, as far as I'm concerned, as a literary figure, is by George Woodcock. I was just talking to someone from Canada who knows George Woodcock, who is a professor at the University of British Columbia. His book, Thomas Merton, Monk and Poet, A Critical Study, published in 1978. And I might just go on a tangent here and say that the first major conference on Merton was held in 1978 to commemorate the 10th anniversary of his death at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. It was subsequent to that meeting in Vancouver that Merton studies really began to explode. Okay, any questions? Okay, well, we'll move along then. The announced topic tonight was Thomas Merton and the Seven Story Mountain, the book that became a bestseller. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit. But it is my prerogative, since I'm up here talking, to kind of talk about what I'd like to. And I have a good example, because in his lectures to the novices, Merton himself often did this. He would come in, give his announced topic, and then go off on a tangent that had nothing whatsoever to do with the announced topic. And sometimes these are among his more valuable talks. I'd like to bring into my discussion of the Seven Story Mountain something about Merton and his uses of language, and Merton and his sense of humor. Many people often think that this man must have been a very pious, reserved, quiet kind of person. I think those of you who saw the documentary, someone remarked in there that they thought this would be somebody who walked around with his hands folded, muttering prayers under his breath. He wasn't this way at all. In fact, he had at times almost a devilish sense of humor. The Seven Story Mountain was a smash bestseller. We don't know exactly, but probably in the first year, the Seven Story Mountain brought into the Abbey of Gethsemane somewhat over $250,000. And I should probably add here that one of the five vows that Cistercian monks take is a vow of poverty, which meant that all the income from any of Merton's writings went to the Abbey of Gethsemane. Now, Merton was chronically vague on business matters, but he did know that his books had made a lot of money for the Abbey over time, and he wasn't above pointing this out sometimes. In 1949, the Abbey of Gethsemane was running in the red. But there had been a new abbot elected in 1948 who happened to have attended Harvard Business School. This is the abbot with whom Merton had so much difficulty throughout his monastic career. And Don James Fox's idea was to make the abbey a going concern. It certainly was not hurt by the Seven Story Mountain, because a lot of young men flocked to the abbey subsequent to the publication of the Seven Story Mountain. In fact, at one point in the early 50s, they had over 200 monks in residence at Gethsemane in a facility that had probably been designed for about 60 to 75. Dom James also, partially with the proceeds of the Seven Story Mountain, started the Gethsemane cheese and fruitcake industry. And I might as well say this now. Later in the 60s, Merton wrote and posted on the bulletin board at the monastery a takeoff on Joyce Kilmer's trees called Cheese. I don't have the text of the entire poem, but it began something with, like, "I think that I will never see an asset lovely as our cheese." And the last two lines were, "Poems are spun by fools like me. Dollars are made by Trappist cheese." He also got rather caustic in the 1960s when the Abbey Church was renovated. And Merton didn't like machines at all. In fact, one of the things that he was very nervous about was technology anyway, and he was apparently something of a klutz. As the story goes, when he went out with the novices to chop wood, they would not let him use an axe at all. And so the church was totally stripped and totally renovated. And he remarked several places in his journals that he didn't know why he had to be bothered by all this noise when he was paying for all this renovation. He also, as a writer, of course, liked language, liked the use of language. I myself happen to find The Seven Story Mountain rather well written. I think it kind of grabs one, holds one's attention as you move through it. And if that isn't good writing, I don't know what is. If it can capture and hold your attention. At the time The Seven Story Mountain was written, however, there were some doubts about how good a writer Merton actually was. At that point in time, each monastic order, each religious order in the Roman Catholic Church maintained its own board of censors. Now, many people think that the censors existed in order to give the Nihil Obstat, as it was called, which meant that the book was free of moral and doctrinal error. And in fact, they did. That was one of their functions. And of course, a book that managed to get published that didn't have this automatically went on what was called the index, which meant that if you were a Roman Catholic and you read a book on the index, you had committed a mortal sin. But the censors also were charged with editing, making comments on how well things were written. Merton had a great deal of trouble with the censors over The Seven Story Mountain. First, they were not convinced that it was appropriate for a Trappist monk to be writing the story of his life. Here was someone who was supposed to have withdrawn from the world, to have lost his identity. In fact, he had a totally different name. In religion, his name was Lewis. L-O-U-I-S, but always pronounced Lewis, although he was at times called Louis, and sometimes Uncle Louis, by the novices. He happened to get his name because when he came to Gethsemane and went in, the abbot always gave a name, the religious name, to the novice. Some of them, of course, were awful, like Paphnutius and names of other saints and so forth. But the abbot looked at Merton and said, "I see you were born in France. How about Lewis?" Not a very original or profound choice, maybe, but that was his name. Well, anyway, the censors felt that Merton's writing, maybe, wasn't that good. And in fact, one of the Trappist censors suggested that he might do well to take a correspondence course in composition. The problem with the original draft of The Seven Story Mountain, which I have read, is that it's overly long. There are too many digressions, too many tangents, too many places where he gets off the point of the story. And in fact, rather than cutting the meat out of it, some critics have thought The Seven Story Mountain, in fact, one person said that it was castrated by the censors, which is rather a strong term. It wasn't. A lot of garbage was actually cut out that didn't need to be there that tightened the story. And I think to prove the point further, when the British edition was published under the title of Elected Silence, it was edited by Evelyn Waugh, who also felt that there was just too much there, that the book needed to be tightened up and shortened. Waugh wrote to Merton and said, "Words are our material, and we must use them with economy. A carpenter doesn't waste wood, and he went through a whole list of professions where people don't waste their materials. He said, you waste words in a profligate manner. Waugh ended up cutting about another third from the American edition of The Seven Story Mountain. Later, Merton began to play around with language. In his writings, and even in The Seven Story Mountain, which I think contains the seeds of many things that Merton became later, even if it is somewhat narrow in its outlook, there were four things that Merton always talked about in relation to the 20th century that he felt were problems for us. I call them the four A's. Was anxiety, alienation, apathy, and absurdity. And particularly with language, Merton felt we often fell into absurdity. That language for us very often, particularly in a period of time when we are increasingly bombarded by the media, language often comes to have no meaning for us at all. That we just often don't hear what is being said to us. One of his prime examples of this was in the 60s. He rarely saw newspapers and magazines, but he happened to be at the O'Callaghans in Louisville and picked up Vogue or something, and saw a full page ad for our page. And he read it. And he got back then and recorded in his journal. He was just amazed because it went through everything. And then the last line was, our page has something no other perfume has. It has our page. Well, this is a prime example of a tautology. A tautology being something, a word that is defined with the word itself. And Merton goes on in this particular little thing he wrote about the absurdity of language when it is used this way, because all it does is dull our senses. It doesn't tell us anything. He and a friend, Robert Lacks, had an amazing exchange of correspondence, published as a catch of anti-letters, posthumously, in which they played around with language and with the sound of language. And I want to read an excerpt here, if I can find it. Okay, a friend of his had come down, a former Columbia friend, to visit him at the Abbey of Gethsemane. This friend was from New England and had a New England accent. That's what you'll see as I go through this passage somehow. He and the friend and some other people had gone into the airport in Louisville and gone to the restaurant there where Merton loved to go. It's called the Luau Room. And he particularly liked to go there and get a couple of Bloody Marys when in Louisville. And in fact, even with all our renovation of the airport, if you're ever in the Louisville airport, you can still go to the Luau Room. So here's what he says in this letter that he wrote later to his friend, Robert Lacks. He, referring to the friend, was here with a bow wow argument about the VN Waugh. We was in the Hawaiian temples with a father and Miss Pat of the libraries, and we was fight like catch-up dogs over the VN Waugh, and even all the waitresses and hired helps was joining in. I was nearly lynched and stabbed to death with forks, though some was on my side about the Waugh. As he began to experiment with language, he wrote a number of things that are called prose poems. In other words, it's really prose, and yet it isn't quite what we think of as narrative prose. Prose almost put into the form of poetry. And I actually think he comes closer to being a poet in some of these than he does in some of his more conventional poems. Later this evening, there will be a presentation on Hiroshima. And after I found that out, I thought the prose poem I would like to share with you tonight is one that Merton wrote in 1961. It's called Original Child Balm, Points for Meditation to be Scratched on the Walls of a Cave. He titled the poem this because, in fact, the literal translation of the Japanese term for atomic bomb is original child. This book was published by New Directions with drawings by Emil Antonucci. And unlike most of Merton's books in that period, although, and it was slim, you know, I think only had a selling price in 61 of something like $350. It didn't sell well. And so New Directions investigated through some of its distributors to discover why. People in bookstores were putting it in the children's book section. And you can imagine a parent, if a child came running with this book, and they probably wouldn't, it was all black and white and gray, without much of anything that would attract a child, the parent would say, I don't think we need to buy this. Anyway, this is Original Child Balm. It did get taken off the shelves of the children's section. Original Child Balm, Points for Meditation to be Scratched on the Walls of a Cave. One, in the year 1945, an original child was born. The name Original Child was given to it by the Japanese people, who recognized that it was the first of its kind. Two, on April 12, 1945, Mr. Harry Truman became the President of the United States, which was then fighting the Second World War. Mr. Truman was a vice president who became president by accident when his predecessor died of a cerebral hemorrhage. He did not know as much about the war as the president before him did. He knew a lot less about the war than many people did. About 1 hour after Mr. Truman became president, his aides told him about a new bomb, which was being developed by atomic scientists. They called it the atomic bomb. They said scientists had been working on it for 6 years, and that it had so far cost $2 billion. They added that its power was equal to that of 20,000 tons of TNT. A single bomb could destroy a city. One of those present added in a reverent tone that the new explosive might eventually destroy the whole world. But Admiral Leahy told the president the bomb would never work. Three, President Truman formed a committee of men to tell him if this bomb would work, and if so, what he should do with it. Some members of this committee felt that the bomb would jeopardize the future of civilization. They were against its use. Others wanted it to be used in demonstration on a forest of cryptomeria trees, but not against a civil or military target. Many atomic scientists warned that the use of atomic power in war would be difficult and even impossible to control. The danger would be very great. Finally, there were others who believed that if the bomb were used just once or twice on one or two Japanese cities, there would be no more war. They believed the new bomb would produce eternal peace. June 1945, the Japanese government was taking steps to negotiate for peace. On one hand, the Japanese ambassador tried to interest the Russian government in acting as a go-between with the United States. On the other hand, an unofficial approach was made secretly through Mr. Alan Dulles in Switzerland. The Russians said they were not interested and that they would not negotiate. Nothing was done about the other proposal, which was not official, after all. The Japanese high command was not in favor of asking for peace. that wanted to continue the war, even if the Japanese mainland were invaded. The generals believed that the war should continue until everybody was dead. The Japanese generals were professional soldiers. 5. In the same month of June, the President's Committee decided that the new bomb should be dropped on a Japanese city. This would be a demonstration of the bomb on a civil and military target. As demonstration, it would be a kind of show. Civilians all over the world love a good show. The destructive aspect of the bomb would be its military. 6. The same committee also asked if America's friendly ally, the Soviet Union, should be informed of the atomic bomb. Someone suggested that this information would make the Soviet Union even more friendly than it was already. But all finally agreed that the Soviet Union was now friendly enough. 7. There was discussion about which city should be selected as the first target. Some wanted it to be Kyoto, an ancient capital of Japan and a center of the Buddhist religion. Others said no, this would cause bitterness. As a result of a chance conversation, Mr. Stimson, the Secretary of War, had recently read up on the history and beauties of Kyoto. He insisted that this city should be left untouched. Some wanted Tokyo to be the first target, but others argued that Tokyo had already been practically destroyed by fire raids and could no longer be considered a legitimate target. So it was decided Hiroshima was the most opportune target, as it had not yet been bombed at all. Lucky Hiroshima. What others had experienced over a period of 4 years would happen to Hiroshima in a single day. Much time would be saved, and time is money. 8. When they bombed Hiroshima, they would put the following out of business: the Ube Nitrogen Fertilizer Company, the Ube Soda Company, the Nippon Motor Oil Company, the Sumitomo Chemical Company, the Sumitomo Aluminum Company, and of course, most of the inhabitants. 9. At this time, some atomic scientists protested again, warning that the use of the bomb in war would tend to make the United States unpopular. But the President's Committee was by now fully convinced that the bomb had to be used. Its use would arouse the attention of the Japanese military class and give them food for thought. 10. Admiral Leahy renewed his declaration that the bomb would not explode. 11. On the 4th of July, when the United States, in displays of fireworks, celebrates its independence from British rule, the British and Americans agreed together that the bomb ought to be used against Japan. 12. On July 7th, the Emperor of Japan pleaded with the Soviet government to act as mediator for peace between Japan and the Allies. Molotov said the question would be studied. In order to facilitate this study, Soviet troops in Siberia prepared to attack the Japanese. The Allies had, in any case, been urging Russia to join the war against Japan. However, now that the atomic bomb was nearly ready, some thought it would be better if the Russians took a rest. 13. The time was coming for the new bomb to be tested in the New Mexico desert. A name was chosen to designate this secret operation. It was called Trinity. 14. At 5:30 a.m. on July 16, 1945, a plutonium bomb was successfully exploded in the desert of Alamogordo, New Mexico. It was suspended from a 100-foot steel tower, which evaporated. There was a fireball a mile wide. The great flash could be seen for a radius of 250 miles. A blind woman miles away said she perceived light. There was a cloud of smoke 40,000 feet high. It was shaped like a toadstool. 15. Many who saw the experiment expressed their satisfaction in religious terms. A semi-official report even quoted a religious book, the New Testament. Quote, "Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief." There was an atmosphere of devotion, it was a great act of faith. They believed the explosion was exceptionally powerful. 16. Admiral Leahy, still a doubting Thomas, said that the bomb would not explode when dropped from a plane over a city. Others may have had faith, but he had his own variety of hope. 17. On July 21st, a full written report of the explosion reached President Truman at Potsdam. The report was documented by pictures. President Truman read the report and looked at the pictures before starting out for the conference. When he left, his mood was jaunty and his step was light. 18. That afternoon, Mr. Stimson called on Mr. Churchill and laid before him a sheet of paper bearing a code message about the successful test. The message read, "Babies satisfactorily born." Mr. Churchill was quick to realize that there was more in this than met the eye. Mr. Stimson satisfied his legitimate curiosity. 19. On this same day, 60 atomic scientists who knew of the test signed a petition that the bomb should not be used against Japan without a convincing warning and an opportunity to surrender. At this time, the USS Indianapolis, which had left San Francisco on the 18th, was sailing toward the island of Tinian with some U-235 in a lead bucket. The fissionable material was about the size of a softball, but there was enough for one atomic bomb. Instructions were that if the ship sank, the uranium was to be saved first, before any life. The mechanism of the bomb was on board the USS Indianapolis, but it was not yet assembled. 20. On July 26, the Potsdam Declaration was issued. An ultimatum was given to Japan: surrender unconditionally or be destroyed. Nothing was said about the new bomb. Pamphlets dropped all over Japan threatened an enormous air bombardment if the army would not surrender. On July 26th, the USS Indianapolis arrived at Tinian and the bomb was delivered. 21. On July 28th, since the Japanese High Command wished to continue the war, the ultimatum was rejected. A censored version of the ultimatum appeared in the Japanese press with the comment that it was an attempt to drive a wedge between the military and the Japanese people. But the emperor continued to hope that the Russians, after studying his proposal, would help to negotiate a peace. On July 30th, Mr. Stimson revised a draft of the announcement that was to be made after the bomb was dropped on the Japanese target. The statement was much better than the original draft. 22. On August 1st, the bomb was assembled in an air-conditioned hut on Tinian. Those who handled the bomb referred to it as Little Boy. Their care for the original child was devoted and tender. 23. On August 2nd, President Truman was the guest of His Majesty, King George VI, on board the HMS Renown in Plymouth Harbor. The atomic bomb was praised. Admiral Leahy, who was present, declared that the bomb would not work. His Majesty George VI offered a small wager to the contrary. 24. On August 2nd, a special message from the Japanese foreign minister was sent to the Japanese ambassador in Moscow. It is requested that further efforts be exerted, since the loss of one day may result in 1,000 years of regret. It is requested that you immediately have a talk with Molotov. But Molotov did not return from Potsdam until the day the bomb fell. 25. On August 4th, the bombing crew on Tinian watched a movie of Trinity, the Alamogordo test. August 5th was a Sunday, but there was little time for formal worship. They said a quick prayer that the war might end very soon. On that day, Colonel Tibbetts, who was in command of the B-29, and was to drop the bomb, felt that his bomber ought to have a name. He baptized it Enola Gay, after his mother in Iowa. Colonel Tibbetts was a well-balanced man and not sentimental. He did not have a nervous breakdown after the bombing like some of the other members of the crew. 26. On Sunday afternoon, little boy was brought out in procession and devoutly tucked away in the womb of Enola Gay. That evening, few were able to sleep. They were as excited as little boys on Christmas Eve. 27. At 1:37 a.m. August 6th, the Weather Scout plane took off. It was named the Straight Flush, in reference to the mechanical action of a water closet. There was a picture of one on the side of the plane to make this evident. 28, at the last minute, before taking off, Colonel Tibbetts changed the secret radio call sign from visitor to dimples. The bombing mission would be a kind of flying smile. 29, at 2:45 a.m., Enola Gay got off the ground with difficulty. Over Iwo Jima, she met her escort, two more B-29s, one of which was called the Great Artiste. Together, they proceeded to Japan. 30, at 6:40, they climbed to 31,000 feet, the bombing altitude. The sky was clear. It was a perfect morning. 31, at 3:09, they reached Hiroshima and started the bomb run. The city was full of sun. The flyers could see the green grass in the gardens. No fighters rose up to meet them. There was no flak. No one in the city bothered to take cover. 32, the bomb exploded within 100 feet of the aiming point. The fireball was 1,800 feet across. The temperature at the center of the fireball was 100 million degrees. The people who were near the center became nothing. The whole city was blown to bits, and the ruins all caught fire instantly, everywhere, burning briskly. 70,000 people were killed right away or died within a few hours. Those who did not die at once suffered great pain. Few of them were soldiers. 33. The men in the plane perceived that the raid had been successful, but they thought of the people in the city and they were not perfectly happy. Some felt they had done wrong, but in any case, they had obeyed orders. It was war. 34. Over the radio went the code message. Papers were forbidden to publish any news of the new bomb. A four-line item said that Hiroshima had been hit by incendiary bombs and added, it seems that some damage was caused to the city and its vicinity. 36. Then the military governor of the prefecture of Hiroshima issued a proclamation full of martial spirit. To all the people without hands, without feet, with their faces falling off, with their intestines hanging out, with their whole bodies full of radiation, he declared, "We must not rest a single day in our war effort. We must bear in mind that the annihilation of the stubborn enemy is our road to revenge." He was a professional soldier. 37. On August 8th, Molotov finally summoned the Japanese ambassador. At last, neutral Russia would give an answer to the emperor's inquiry. Molotov said coldly that the Soviet Union was declaring war on Japan. 38, on August 9th, another bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, though Hiroshima was still burning. On August 11th, the emperor overruled his high command and accepted the peace terms dictated at Potsdam. Yet for 3 days, discussion continued. until on August 14th, the surrender was made public and final. 39. Even then, the Soviet troops thought they ought to fight in Manchuria just a little longer. They felt that even though they could not at this time be of help in Japan, it would be worthwhile if they displayed their goodwill in Manchuria or even in Korea. 40. As to the original child that was now born, President Truman summed up the philosophy of the situation in a few words. "We found the bomb," he said, "and we used it." 41. Since that summer, many other bombs have been found. What is going to happen? At the time of writing, after a season of brisk speculation, men seem to be fatigued by the whole question. Let me kind of end on a slightly lighter note. I've been wanting for 3 days to say a little bit about Thomas Merton and what I feel was his real ability to communicate with young people. He was always very open with young people. When Tommy O'Callaghan's children came out with her one time for a picnic, they brought all those little rubbery spiders and bugs that you make in kids making molds, and they brought a whole selection to Merton as a present, which he cheerfully accepted and then went through the Abbey, leaving them on dictionaries in the library, next to the abbot's dinner plate in the refectory, and so forth. But in 1967, a young girl in California named Suzanne Batorovich started a correspondence with Merton, which is probably one of the most delightful exchanges in the nearly 2,000 files we have. She originally wrote to him and said, "I'm one of your fans, 1-8-M. Oops, I think that was supposed to be I'M. 16 and a half years old, so if you answer, do not go far above my head. Okay? Yes?" She signed off with, "This letter is a disaster." He wrote back to her at once, and soon he was addressing letters to Dear Disaster. She wrote back to him, calling him the hippie hermit. She introduced Thomas Merton to the Beatles, and in fact sent him his first Beatles record. One of her letters is a letter of anguish because she had heard that Paul McCartney had married. And Merton wrote back and he said he was really sorry that Paul had married before she got a chance to meet him, but that perhaps in time Suzanne would meet a man just as wonderful as Paul McCartney. She was one of the few people who ever dared to ask Merton, "Tell me something. If you were asked to revise Seven Story Mountain, would you? And what would you cut out and what would you keep?" He wrote back, "If I had to rewrite Seven Story Mountain, I'd cut a lot of the sermons, I guess, including the sales pitch for Catholic schools and all that." Now, one of the most delightful things is she wrote to Merton when the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein, died, asking Merton to say a mass for Epstein, even though she said, "Do you Catholics say masses for Jews?" Merton wrote back and said, "I'm terribly sorry to hear about Brian Epstein. I'll say mass for him on September 5th. Did I ever tell you that once on a radio program, he was asked to name his favorite book, and he named Seven Story Mountain, only with its English title, Elected Silence. I always felt closer to him after that." To kind of finish up, the Seven Story Mountain is Thomas Merton's classic work. It is the work that has been most translated. It is the work, I feel, for which he will be most remembered over time. And to finish, I would like to give a quote from Clare Booth Luce. This quote is from 1948, when neither Mrs. Luce nor her husband apparently used inclusive language, but I will quote it in its original. In speaking of the seven-story mountain, Clare Booth Luce said, "It is to a book such as this that men will turn 100 years from now to discover what went on in the heart of man in our cruel century." Thank you. Okay, any questions? We're getting on toward Vesper's time. The book is in the bookstore. It's the first selection in the nonviolent alternative. Yes. Fourth. The Japanese term, the seven-story mountain is from Dante. And the seven circles up from Purgatory.
Can you show that video that you showed?